Hi everyone, welcome back to Prevention Nation,
where we believe education and awareness can change the culture of violence. I'm Caitlin Wagenfield.
And I'm Roy Letts.
Please note, in this episode, we are discussing topics that could be triggering to some listeners.
Feel free to skip this episode if you need or want. Welcome back to Prevention Nation. It's Roy and Abby here, and we have a couple wonderful guests that are in-house, Safe on Main guests. Who are you?
I am Geraldine Barnett. I am our community response coordinator.
Okay.
And I used to work in our shelter, and over the last year, I've been in this position. I do our hospital response and our community coordinated response team.
Okay. Sounds good. And who's our other guest over there sitting there in the corner?
And my name is JC Jackson, and I also work at Safe on Main. I head up our volunteer program, and I am also on the hospital response team as well.
Okay. Well, thank you both for being here and on our podcast. So, today on our podcast, we're going to talk about the Gabby Petito case. And yeah, as we were talking about before, we could go chronological, we could go through the movie, we could start out, you know, with what, you know, right in the beginning of the movie and what stood out to us, or we could just kind of jump around. But I mean, I don't know, I'll leave it up to the group, but I'm going to start right away with the call to 911 reporting of a domestic slapping her and that she was crying and stuff. That to me was, you know, it started out right there, but then it jumped back and it went kind of into the story. But that caught me just because that's how oftentimes we're in this field, we our first interaction with the victim or perpetrator is that 911 call, some call for help, right? Or to our emergency line or our crisis line or something. And I just think that set a really interesting tone for the whole show. Then we can just jump right into some of the relationship stuff we saw in the beginning. Like, they started dating, you know, he showed tons of signs of jealousy, tons of signs of control.
I got a lot on that in their text messaging.
Yeah, so talk about
that. So many red flags. First of all, his artwork, to me, is a huge red flag because it depicted a lot of violence, a lot of just, and I don't mean just a little bit, like, it was pretty graphic, some of the stuff that he was into. They didn't go into a lot of that in the documentary on Netflix, but I had read and heard some of the reports about that, and I thought it was interesting because in the Netflix doc, it did show a little bit of her journal entry, and I thought that was very interesting. And so what I did was I paused it on that page because
did some research?
Yes, they only highlighted certain things that she said, which is fine, but I read the stuff that they didn't highlight, and that was very concerning to me and like very much a red flag. So she has,
you're seeing on the screen when they something was like that bubble or something was highlighted, but there was other stuff around that they didn't show.
Yes.
So okay.
Wrote that down.
Yes, it's like a whole. It's her like this. It's a page the written, but they only. It was kind of like muted and blurry, and they only like highlighted a few things. So her note said, "Brian, you know how much I love you. Just please stop crying and calling me names because we're a team and I'm here with you. I'm always going to have your back. I'm sorry I got so upset over a piece of paper, but I just really wanted to do that with you. You know, really, this is all your fault because you're into all of that, all of this cool stuff that I was sheltered from." So that makes me wonder, what was really, there's so much more to this that we will never know, but the only things that they highlighted on there was, "Brian, you know how much I love you, just please stop crying and calling me names."
So for our listeners, it's Brian Laundry is his name.
Yes.
You know, let's jump back for a second, because when you mentioned, when you were talking about his artwork and how dark it was.
Yes.
I did think, I was kind of surprised that they didn't bring more of that into it, because at the very end, when he, after he killed her, and he was walking around doing his little walk tour to make it, you know, give himself that time and space away from her body, he took pictures of dead animals and skulls and stuff. And so it just, it's funny. It started out with this dark art and it ended completely circular with this dark photographic imagery or artwork that he was, I mean, it was, I thought that was interesting. But anyways, so.
And then it goes on to show some of her artwork in those journals. And one of them was a picture of a blonde girl, like, upset and crying. And it had a speech bubble that said, I dreamt you were going to destroy the world. And when I asked you why, you said it was because of me.
Interesting.
And so then there was another one. It was a picture of, like, legs and feet walking on broken glass. There were shards of glass and the feet were bleeding. And so that was her depiction of how she had to basically walk on eggshells around him. And they showed that right after their text thread, which is classic DV 101. I mean, there's so many red flags just in that strand of text messages. It's unreal. Like, it just completely unfolded and you can see the manipulation.
Oh, yeah, all the crying, even when just all of his crying, and like, I wish you were here, and it would, how it would be, how he was crying, but then it would stop crying, and it was just, I wish you were here, I'm sorry, but I'm good, but I'm so sad without you. It was all this guilt and stuff, so.
So he was really, like, gaslighting with the way he would talk to her in these text messages, because, like, it got worse when she started working. They said she was working at Taco Bell.
Yeah, Taco Bell.
Because she was trying to fund
and
them.
She had her friend, and
yes,
definitely got
she had
jealous
a friend,
of the friend.
And he would be, so he would get really upset with her and start crying, carrying on. He stole her ID one night. And
so she couldn't leave and couldn't get out. But then he did all that, you know, said DV 101. But then he, I think the friend and them talked about, then he would shower her with gifts.
Yes.
All these gifts that were
exactly
proximity
yes.
to the event.
He'll say, I'll be happy when I see you, but I'm so pissed right now. I effing hate that you ever worked at Taco Bell with all those lowlifes. So then she apologizes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I don't know why you had to turn into one of them. Effing disgusting. So then he says, please, please, please forgive me for calling your mom, but I'm effed in every aspect of my life right now. I just wanted this week to go smoothly. I'm crying so hard in the dumb effing bathroom typing this. And I know you love me, and I'm so sorry. I worry you'll leave. It's just that I couldn't have my life without you. So then it prompts her, no, no, honey, I didn't want you to be sad today. I love you so much. I'm sorry. I will never leave. So she's apologizing.
And why is she responsible for his happiness?
Right. That's
like,
exactly,
I don't want you to be sad, so what is it? Why is it on her?
That's where the manipulation and the coercive control comes in, because he is making her responsible for his feelings.
Mm-hmm.
She's responsible for his happiness.
She can't even go to work. She can't. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, everybody, but like, nowhere in there did I ever get any indication that Brian ever had a job. Did
he
work?
I asked the same thing. So I Googled it, and he worked at in the grocery department or something at a Publix. And he quit that when the pandemic started of COVID-19. And then he worked at, like, a juice bar or something after that. So, very minimal. So
she's working. She's providing. She's the one earning all the money for this van and all that stuff. And he's
his parents.
And he's just guilt-tripping her.
And makes her feel bad that she can't be with him and accommodate him all day long and coddle him. So she's essentially bearing the burden for his happiness, and when he's not happy, then it's her fault too.
Yeah.
And then it kind of sounds like with their messaging and things that when he wasn't happy, it almost seems like she was almost afraid of what he might do as far as like self-harm, things like that. So she was always apologizing, and like she even said, I didn't want you to be sad today.
Yep.
So, and then he can't stop crying, and then he turns around and showers her with gifts and does these romantic, you know, gestures and all this stuff, and pulls her back in. So he's constantly doing this push-pull of, mm-hmm. you know, you're responsible for me and my happiness. Oh, you didn't do a good job this time, so now I'm going to push you away.
Which
and
keeps
I'm gonna
her completely
beat you down.
Off balance.
Yes, and her emotions
stable.
Are all over the place. And then it's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Let me do this for you. Let me. And then she's to the point where she's like, he's so good to me. I don't deserve him.
Yeah.
It's just the classic. That's what we hear all the time on crisis calls. And
so what you saw on this first episode, what any of us saw on this first, the first episode wasn't anything different than what we're used to seeing in this work,
nope.
in this field.
This is, I mean,
was there anything about it that surprised any of you? Anything that shocked you in the first episode that you thought, you know, because this is, for our listeners, if you haven't watched it, this is a three-part series about Gabby Petito and Brian Laundry and the murder of Gabby Petito. And, yeah, so we're kind of criticizing and critiquing how this case went and how it was handled. For our listeners, Geraldine has a literal notebook here of notes.
Yeah.
So the rest of us are probably going to falter in our ability to recollect things the way Geraldine is. I'm surprised you don't have screenshots.
So I'm super into this. You know how I am.
No, that's fantastic. But is there anything else? So we start this, we start seeing this relationship develop. We see all sorts of red flags. Any green flags? Any green flags that you see, Abby or JC?
Not with him.
Really?
One thing that actually my husband had pointed out was there were some physical features of him that reminded me a little bit of her stepfather and her dad, and I thought that was an interesting observation.
Okay.
Immediately when I saw her stepfather, I was like, oh my gosh, he looks like her dad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought that about the mother and the... I thought all the parents looked...
They
clearly
right.
had a type.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
so
her
she,
first boyfriend looked just like him, too, almost.
Yeah.
She had a very clear type.
Yeah.
I guess the green flag I saw was that, like, in the beginning it showed how when she was a baby she was just this free spirit, loved to go, and she was very artistic. I mean, that girl
mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm.
quite an artist. And his art, while it was dark, was actually very good, too.
Yeah.
And he was very adventurous, too. So I think one of the green flags I saw, and I think, you know, and I ask about green flags because we know in DV cases, there is love there. There is love there. It's just also sick, you know, and there's lots
of unhealthy
things.
I think sometimes green flags can be...
they're a reason to stay for a lot of people.
Yes, but I think sometimes in the beginning, love bombing and things like that can be mistaken for green flags.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I guess what I just observed was that they were both young, mm-hmm. Free spirited, and had
a lot of common interests.
Common interests, artistic, and they seemed to be, on the same track as far as what they were kind of going after, a van life, kind of taking off and exploring life. And I thought that was kind of cool. And I think that might have been part of the appeal that kept her so locked in. I mean, I don't know.
Although go ahead, Abby.
I was going to say, just talking about the van life thing, it also, I can't remember if it was the first or second episode where it's they left his parents' home because they were living wherever, I forget, more Midwesty, North, wherever her parents were, and then they went down to Florida where his parents lived.
Yeah, they were up in New York, and then
New
they
York,
went down
right.
to yeah, Florida.
And then that started out healthy. Well,
but mom started
healthier,
being mean.
Yeah, that
and
was weird.
And then so that's kind of showing a little bit of isolation, removing mm-hmm. her from her support, her
yeah.
family. And then, yeah, things start out fine with his family and parents, but it's obvious also that his mom and later... I think the dad part comes out more, have a very unhealthy relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Had a very unhealthy relationship towards or, you know, just, I don't know, certain behaviors and things you can tell in those beginning episodes. It's not just in the end that you see that his parents also had some red flags towards her.
Yeah, absolutely. JC?
I was going similar but a little different. You were talking about them having things in common. I think the van was hers, it was in her name,
mm-hmm.
and I think she and her previous boyfriend had originally planned to do
mm-hmm.
the van trip. So, mm-hmm. while they were both artists, I think he might have just kind of...
caught the wave.
...cling on to the, oh, let's do... Because he didn't... She made it seem like he wasn't really interested in being in the videos. He wasn't really
Yeah, he didn't
want to
do the whole blog
doing
thing.
The blog. So, and yes, he was an outdoorsman. I'm sure he liked camping and hiking and all that. Yeah. But at
a lot more than I understand anybody. Like, why does anybody like to camp that much? But anyways, that's just
I used to do it
so,
a lot. But
I know, I get it.
I can see that part. So I think maybe he just kind of, this is great because we'll be off on our own. So again, a little bit more isolating. But I don't really think that he shared that desire to really do that whole
Okay, so he was just kind of along for the ride. It was
literally,
I could see.
Okay,
that.
Literally and figuratively.
I think he didn't like the blog idea and the video stuff because he was afraid of what might be caught on camera,
how he might look or what he might say.
Yes.
Well, and understandably, if you know, nobody knows your motives like you do, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you know that you're faking it, or you know that you're, you know, not. I don't know. Whatever
yeah,
it is,
I
guess that would be a concern.
No matter how good your relationship is and how healthy it is, that's going to be a stressful situation. When you are living in a small, confined space, constantly traveling and on the road, and you're striking out doing this new thing, and like she was kind of going on about like some of the editing, like, well, if you could knew how to edit at all, you know what I mean? So there was, I'm sure, a lot of bickering and tension and like my husband and I have a good relationship, but if you put us in a tiny van on the road for weeks, months at a time, I can't guarantee the outcome of that. I mean, that's just
my wife and I used to joke.
To be some stress.
Absolutely, my wife and I used to joke when that show Amazing Race came out. We used to joke we should go on this, and we were like, "Well, that would be the world watching us get a divorce." Because I mean, you put us in that kind of tense situation, we're gonna fight. And I think one of her friends, Gabby Petito's friends, said that like. Made some reference in the movie about a documentary about how Gabby thought it was going to be so great, but there's a hard side to just living a van life. It's not all romanticized
and
stuff. It's hard. I mean, you're filling up gas and you're sitting there for endless hours driving and
cooking, cleaning.
It's so much more effort. Showering. I mean, at one point with the law enforcement, you know, they suggest she just go and get a shower. And they even reference his body odor, so I imagine these two are kind of dirty.
Right.
Okay. So we have all these red flags. They get on the road. They're traveling across the country. They're in, you know. And I think it's so interesting where, when we have like murder cases like this, and they go out to that part of the country. I don't know if either of you ever been out to Moab and like Utah. That's some desolate. Desolate area, just
absolutely
huge. Like when my wife and I moved out here, people drive around to vacations all the time, but out there you don't just drive around in the West Coast. Everything is really far apart.
Yeah.
So like it just feels so isolating anyway. So I guess I think to myself, the comment about being isolated, if I'm an abuser, what a perfect place
exactly
to bring somebody to.
And I think that's why he was desperate to get on the road and go. I don't think, like we were saying, I don't really think he was on board with that. I don't think that was his dream life. But it, like in one of his texts, he said something like, I was alone for so long and I was happy. But now that I love you so much, every second alone, I'm stuck with a person I hate. That's a very contradictory statement. I was alone.
When did he make that statement?
It was in their text messages.
Because I was going
to
say, I
don't. To the details.
See, I'm all about the fine details.
She had her
wow, that's a really powerful statement.
Yes, because he's essentially, that's so contradictory. I was alone for so long and I was so happy. But now that I love you so much, every minute I'm alone, I'm stuck with a person I hate. You hate yourself, but you were so happy when you were alone makes absolutely no sense.
It makes it seem like she's turned him into someone he doesn't like.
Exactly. And he's putting that on her. And that's when she was with her friend and she commented back a few texts later and said, you know, I really don't like the way that you talk to me. I wish that you know, it really hurts my feelings. And I think her giving a little bit of pushback and her using her voice, that was a moment of clarity for him. Like, the only way that I can keep control of this is to isolate her. So I got to get, and that's when he said, I hate to keep bothering you by texting you how much I love you, but I really do miss you. I'm sorry I've been so anxious. I'm really focusing trying to get our life together so we can get on the road. And so he was like, this is the only way that I can do it. So he gives her something positive and then push back. But then he says, like, a few minutes later, he says something like, oh, man, she didn't answer him right away. So he says, oh, man, you took over the Spotify, but you can't text me back. I miss you so much, but that really hurts my feelings.
Yeah.
Like, all of his messages are completely, yes,
monitoring,
tracking everything,
so,
and then he's got to get that passive-aggressive in there, but then follows it up with, I miss you so much, but that really hurts my feelings. Like, so, and abuse is not an anger issue. I hate when people say that. It's all about control.
Yeah.
It's not anger.
Okay.
It is control.
Then, JC, let me ask you. If Geralyn says it's all about control, right, and that's what we understand about DV, and we know that it's already been, we've already discussed a little bit about how difficult it must be to be trapped in a small environment, a van, on the van life and stuff. Did maybe the situation exacerbate his need for control? Like, would he have done this had they not gone on this road trip? Would he have killed her?
So, yes. I think yes.
Geralyn's a hard yes
honestly,
on this one.
Honestly, I can say I lived for 2 months in a car driving across country with my boyfriend.
Yeah.
And did something very similar. Now, this was before blogs, you know, so we weren't documenting everything. But yeah, little moments of feeling dirty and feeling tired and where are we going to do laundry, you know, and all of that. But never once in that situation did either one of us ever cross a line, you know, of a control or anything like that. I think he would have, he had already started, like you said, from bringing her from New York to Florida. I think there just would have been a different way to isolate her. Maybe it wasn't the trip. But I think the trip was perfect because she was so about it that she overlooks the red flags because he's finally giving her what it is that she wanted. And so he can make himself look like a hero in that moment by giving her what she wants, even though it's going to benefit him.
Okay, so I guess that prompts me then to ask you, Geralyn. So, like, you say it's not about anger, it's about control.
Yeah.
I mean, do you believe that Brian started out that road trip with the idea that I'm going
to
kill her?
Not the intent to kill her, no. But control and isolate,
yeah.
Yes. He was all about that coercive control. And honestly, I can't even say that in the heat of the moment he meant to kill her.
Yeah.
But I think because the autopsy reports were blunt force trauma to the head and manual strangulation.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
It's possible. I mean, I know I say that it's not an anger issue. It's not. And I say that because when they got pulled over, it a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
Because
how calm he was.
They both admitted when he hit that curb and they turned the lights on, they were arguing. He said he was yelling.
Yeah.
And you notice how calm and courteous.
How do you calm down that
fast
from a near accident, hitting a curb?
Exactly.
Fighting. Yeah.
So it's just like if you're at home, you're in a heated debate, you know, all this is happening. Somebody knocks on the door. Instantly, they can open that door. Hey, officer, what's the problem? It is not about anger.
Well,
because if you're angry and you're raging, you can't stop that.
And we were actually talking about rage right before we started the podcast and how we all, different situations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's a perfect example of.
Yeah.
In none of these situations that we all were talking about where we all would have reacted or acted a little differently, do I think any of us could have instantly, to your point, if someone oversaw these altercations with our partners, that we would have been able to turn it off. Or, you know what?
Right.
Like,
practice.
There's no way.
And
practice
then she also
right.
said,
yeah.
And she said that she totally downplayed it when they were asking, and they said, you have a mark here, you know, and she didn't even acknowledge that at first. She wouldn't make eye contact. She wouldn't. She kept looking away and stuttering.
Putting blame on herself.
You know, yeah. And she's like, well, I hit him first. I guess I hit him first is what she said. But then she says, he grabbed my face like this.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody grabs your face like this or puts their hands around your neck, what are you going to do? Your natural instinct is going to be to fight back. His injuries, how they're saying, oh, well, you got a scratch here and some scratches. Yes, those are defensive wounds. She was trying to get him off of her.
Which brings up a point, like, and that really frustrated me. The officers received, the call that they received was not, a woman slapping a man or hitting a guy and him trying to defend himself or walk away. Because Brian kept saying to the police, I was just trying to walk away. I was just trying to push her away to it so I could walk away and tell her to calm down. The call, 911 call that, you know, I started this podcast with, that started the show out with, was that a witness said, we saw a man multiple slapping a girl multiple times. So he was slapping her. So that to me gets to the whole idea of these were defensive wounds. She was fighting to save herself. Well,
and like we were saying, the way that they acted when the police pulled up, that she's crying, she's shaking, she all these things, and he's just cool as a cucumber.
Right. Yeah.
This
says, and I read this, I quote, the individual that called 911 says, the gentleman was slapping the girl. They ran up and down the sidewalk where he proceeded to hit her, hopped in the car, and they drove off.
Yeah, not a single report that she hit him or assaulted him. Mm-hmm. So at least some witness saw her being victimized.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then all of a sudden we pull over and, yeah, I mean, this whole super calm, which to me is weird because when he saw those lights, I don't know if any of you have ever made any mistakes in your life. Stole a little something, ran a red light, did something a little illegal, right? And you know darn well you're caught when you get caught, right? That anxiety is... When those lights went on behind his and Gabby's vehicle, he was able to remain calm, even though he was, I bet, pretty sure he was going to jail that day.
Oh, yeah. When that cop walked up, he knew he was going to jail. Because when he started giving his statement, when they were asking him, they had him behind the van, and they were asking, and he started to kind of stumble. He's like, well, she wasn't exactly on me, but like, and he was really struggling to, so the other officer interjects.
Right.
And starts to put words into his mouth. He's like, so basically a lot of hands and a lot, and he's like, yeah, and a lot of nails and rings. Like,
yeah. Totally, it really worked in
there. Well, then you have it combined with her saying, oh, it's all me, it's all my fault. All of a sudden, in the cops' brains, they flip it as to who the victim is.
So absolutely.
Do you think the officers just believed him? Do you think the officers just didn't want to ask the questions because they didn't want to deal with it? Do you think, you know, I'm curious about that. Even just... the fact that she's such a small, young girl.
And they brought that up in the documentary, too.
They said that the officer even said, this girl is 110 pounds. I perceive no danger to him, no threat to him. Other than maybe a few scratches. And they see this mark on her eye, which they showed the picture afterwards. And it was definitely, she got hit in the eye. For sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know what was on her arm that they called out. And he's got a few scratches. You've got this little tiny girl.
Yeah.
They know she's of no threat.
Eyewitness accounts.
Eyewitness accounts. And I love when he says, to the officer, I don't have the quote, but he says something like, I hope she's not saying too many bad things about me back there, or I hope she, you know.
And he makes like a little laugh.
Yeah, and he makes a little laugh. And I guess all of that stuff kind of lends to JC's question, which is, I think each of us could offer a little to that question. Because I know from my perspective, I mean, at one point, one of the officers says in there, we have a, you know, like when they were trying to deliberate what to do, the one officer says, well, we could go all the way. We have a full-blown DV case here. So they were acutely aware that they had at least DV on one or if not both people. They could have arrested her or him. And from law enforcement perspective in Oregon and Ohio, it's a mandatory arrest anytime you have a domestic violence dispute.
I wish that they would have. It may have saved her life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then the question to, you know, JC's question is, why didn't they do anything? I'm going to jump in and just say... I think it's paperwork and time. And I want to know when the end of their shift was.
Yes, because the female officer, when they weighed those options, she said, I would rather be dinged for a decision I made than one I didn't make. And then he said, or there's another option. We cannot charge. We can separate them. Let them go their separate ways. And if they get back together, what's it to you?
See, that female officer wanted to make the arrest.
She did.
She wanted to make an arrest.
To do the right thing.
Because
she was doing, would have been doing the right thing, but she was treating Gabby like the perpetrator.
Which would have been fine. Arrest her. I don't even mind.
I think it still would have turned out better for her.
Yes.
Yeah, you let the court sort out, because the court would have sorted out, attorneys would have sorted out that she was actually the victim, and they can drop charges and add charges to somebody else. You would make an arrest, and that's what she wanted to do. She wanted to arrest somebody.
Yes, but she changed her mind after mm-hmm. they said, and if they get back together, what's it to you? They said you provided for his safety. After acknowledging this small girl that had visible marks, and they had eyewitness of him slapping and hitting her.
Yeah.
And then they're providing for his safety, and what's it to you if they get back together?
Yeah.
I would like to know what it is to them now.
I'm very curious about that as well.
Yeah.
I thought about that the whole movie, that I wish it would have come back around. And at the end of this podcast, we'll talk about House Bill 117 or Senate Bill 117 out of Utah. But yeah, I did wonder, what were those official statements of those officers afterward? Mm-hmm. And again, we know that that's not the day she was killed. It wouldn't have necessarily saved her life.
Right.
But it's not just about that separation of space that saves a person's life. It's about that separation of space could have been an opportunity. All she wanted to do was call her mom from that mm-hmm. phone. But how much are you going to say in front of your abuser while you're on your phone with your mom when your abuser's looking right at you? That space could have been an opportunity for her to get some help or to get some intervention that could have left and got her home and safe.
It could have, but instead the female officer instead asked her. And now, mind you, this girl, she doesn't have a record. She's never been arrested. She's never had any, you know, domestic mm-hmm. violence case, anything like that. And the patrol officer asked her, do you want me to say something, anything to him? Do you want me to tell Brian that you love him?
Yeah.
And her response to that was, she didn't even give an audible answer. She just shook her head. And she said, make sure he doesn't forget his phone charger. It's definitely dead. She could have connected her with a DV resource or something. Could have made a huge difference to this girl if they had arrested her, if they had separated her, put her in a hotel, and maybe given her a resource, somebody to talk to.
Just a resource.
Validate what you're saying, what you're going through. And I'm just going to be frank with you. This is an abusive relationship, and this is what you're looking at. There are resources and help for you if you're interested.
Yeah, a lot of people are unaware that the relationship they're in.
Yes.
Because none of us want to believe that what we're in is super unhealthy or dangerous, right? So a lot of people are unaware of the extent of the abuse that their relationship is. So yeah, I mean, that time alone could have been a resource for somebody to talk to her, an advocate, and her to realize, you're right, I haven't really felt safe for a while. Or you just never know what that outcome could have been. JC, you posed the question, why do you think the officers didn't do it?
I don't know. A part of me feels like they just didn't take it seriously. Like, they just, it's just two young kids. They're just
passionate.
This is nothing. I also just think maybe there's a lack of education mm-hmm. in general. Like you were saying, people don't realize the relationship they're in. People don't realize that resources are available, you know, just the opportunity. And I'm thinking probably a little of what you said too. Like, I'm not going to do all this paperwork. I'm not going to, she's clearly not going to really do much hurt to him. So if we do our good deed and we separate them, and then after that it's on them.
Well, you're making an assumption there that they honestly believe that she is the aggressor, because you just said, what's the point, you know, she's not going to hurt him. They got a report that he was hitting her, and she has marks.
And they totally
why would they not regard her safety?
It was easier for them to turn it into a mental health case.
It was easier, and that's how it got reported.
And we all know that mental health can go dark so quickly for her or for him. Like, that's also just as concerning, because we know she could have hurt herself or him because it was mental health, not...
Right.
You know what I
mean? And that is possible.
Yeah.
However, when they get her out and she's saying, she's so upset and shaken, and she's saying, I just have OCD. Sometimes I get really upset. those are all the things that he tells her on the daily, I'm sure. He's telling her she's crazy all the time. You're so OCD. This is why I get so upset. This is why I blow up and I freak out and go off the deep end on you, because you're perfectionist and you're constantly nagging. I mean, I can just hear it all playing out in my head. And the thing that pissed me off the most is that the officer totally, like, fed into that.
I agree.
And so when he tells her, you know, you can go down the road and, you know, whatever, and you can get a shower for $45.
Yeah, he started talking about his own wife. Like, it helps my wife to calm down.
He totally
she takes a warm shower.
Smack about his own wife.
Yeah.
And
putting
saying,
his own wife's mental health out in
there. Put that out there for everybody and saying she takes medication daily and sometimes it's still not enough. Mm-hmm. So, you know what helps when she gets like that is to go take a hot shower. And he's like chumming it up with Brian.
Yeah, what
girl,
mental health professional
think,
tells you, if medication isn't working, a shower will fix your mental health crisis. No, a shower doesn't help the mental health crisis.
I tell you what, if his wife didn't know that before this documentary came out, she was not happy with him when he got home that day.
According to him, all she needs to do to calm down is take a shower.